Tenants in Brickell win a legal battle over fees, but will that change the way condo associations operate? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. A group of residents came together in a class action lawsuit claiming that their condo association overcharged them on fees. Now, those fees are set by law. There are other lawsuits happening now, but what will this decision mean for the way these associations operate? Also, Cubans have enjoyed a unique immigration status in the United States, but things started to change under President Obama. Now, under the Trump administration, there's a new effort to deport more Cubans and make asylum, something that was a given, hard to get. And
this is an opportunity for a victim to share its life with others.
We'll meet Manuel Oliver, father of Joaquin Oliver, who died in Parkland. Manuel is doing a one-man show to honor the life of his son. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. When you buy or rent a condo, there are condo association fees. Now, the law states that those fees are locked at a specific price. But the Miami Herald has found over the years that many of these associations are overcharging and still doing it. A recent court decision in a class action lawsuit ruled in favor of the tenants. But will that change how condo associations operate? And have you ever been told that you'd have to pay more than $100 in fees when you were trying to rent or buy a condo? What happened? Send us a message by texting the word FEE, F-E-E, to 786-786-7636. That's one word, FEE, to 786-786-7636. Standard messaging rates apply. Well, joining me now in studios here at the Miami Herald in Doral is Miami Herald's investigative reporter, Nick Nehemas. Nick, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's remind ourselves of what the Herald discovered, that there are condo associations that are charging more on these application and service fees than the law allows. How did you guys find the story?
So this started 3 years ago, actually, with a tip from a realtor whose clients were complaining to him about these condo fees, you know, application, credit checks, move-in, elevator fees, totaling several hundred dollars, you know, when they wanted to rent or buy a condo. And he, trying to help them, actually did some research and found that unbeknownst to him, and I'd say most people in Florida, state law caps all these fees at $100 per person or married couple. He called us. We did an investigation back in 2016 and found that this law is, you know, widely flouted across the county. And we published our story, and that actually led to the filing of some class action lawsuits, one of which was settled recently, as we reported.
How much were they overcharging?
So the lawsuit that was settled yesterday or last week, they were charging $350 per people, but we or per person. But we've seen fees, you know, up to $600-$700.
When the law says it's capped at $100.
The law seems to be very explicit on this point, according to legal experts and state regulators that we've talked to.
And this is a law that was set quite a while ago. I mean, many years ago.
That's a really important point. This $100 cap dates back to 1992. It hasn't been adjusted since.
So this couple started this class action lawsuit against one particular condo association in Brickell, right?
That's correct.
And they won, so the court's basically saying what?
Well, there was a settlement.
Oh,
so
okay.
The condo association, you know, decided that it wasn't worth fighting this battle anymore, and they agreed to pay up to $300,000 to settle these claims. So
do we know how many people were in that lawsuit?
Up to, I think, 580 or so were eligible. But this is, you know, the fact that the association decided to settle rather than fight this, I think, sends a clear signal to other associations, at least according to the condo law experts we consulted. I mean, they said this does, in a sense, you know, it doesn't set a legal precedent, obviously, but it sets, you know, an example that other associations may want to look to.
And the other thing, too, is this, because you had mentioned it, there are other lawsuits going on right now. That was just for one particular association, against one association.
There are three or four lawsuits, class action lawsuits going on across condos in Miami. And so, you know, one of the lawyers we talked to suggested that, you know, given the number of condo associations, we know charging excessive fees. You know, there could be a cottage industry of lawyers developing to go and help tenants and condo owners reclaim some of these fees that they were seemingly wrongly charged.
Because as you said, this doesn't set a legal precedent, but because it happened and it got settled, do you think that all the other ones kind of just fall into place now?
Well, you'd think that certainly, you know, the association wouldn't have settled if they thought they had a really good shot and a clear path to winning. I mean, that's usually how we interpret these kind of class action settlements. They decided that this amount of money was worth parting with in order to end this particular dispute.
Again, talking with the Miami Herald's investigative reporter, Nick Nehamas, a court ruled in favor of tenants in a class action lawsuit against a Brickell condo association. They say it was overcharging the residents these inflated fees. You could find the story, by the way, on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And have you ever been told you got to pay more than that $100 in fees when you were trying to get your condo? What happened? Again, send us a text. Text the word fee, F-E-E, to 786-786-7636. How many people do you think know? I mean, I wonder how many of your readers have come back to you and said they didn't even know that there was a law and that there was a cap.
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, you know, I've done some big stories at the Miami Herald that I'm very proud of. None has generated the reader contact, calls, letters, emails that this story has since I published it in 2016. I mean, everyone, you know, who tries to rent or buy a condo in this market at some point has come across this problem, and people had no idea. You know, they thought it was a pain to have to pay $250, $300, $500, but, you know, if you're paying rent of $15, $16, $1,700, you're not going to stop based on that one-time fee. You know, you're just going to grit your teeth and pay it. And so people were really outraged, you know, to learn that they didn't in fact have to pay these fees.
All right, let's remind ourselves too of what these fees are. It's application fees, but it's like background checks and a lot of other things.
Yeah, credit reports. You see move in, move out fees are very common. I mean, there are even some buildings where you have to pay a pet fee. So, you know, even your dog or cat is costing you money too. And all these fees are generally held to be in connection with the transfer. They're called transfer fees formally, the transfer of a condo unit, meaning its lease or sale.
And this is still going on, right? It hasn't stopped because there was a settlement.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, we reported on this story 3 years ago, and we did an analysis of condos for sale and lease at that time, and we found that 46% of listings in Miami-Dade advertised transfer fees in excess of $100, which is against the law. 3 years later, despite the media coverage and these class action lawsuits, we redid this exact same analysis, and it's at 42%. The Miami Association of Realtors did it slightly differently and found, you know, 39%. So it's somewhere, you know, between 4 and 10 listings are asking or demanding, really, illegal fees.
How transparent are these associations about their fees? I mean, is it easy to find that information, or do I have to go digging for it?
I mean, it's right on the paperwork, the application paperwork. They lay out, you know, how much the fees are. And to be fair to these condo associations, I mean, it's, you know, it's very likely that many of them didn't understand the law either. But, you know, it is their responsibility to obey the law. And there's certainly, you know, a lot of property management firms that should know the law and yet are charging more. In fact, I mean, in our original story in 2016, there was a lot of pushback from the industry saying that they were following the law. And that pushback has kind of died down in the years since.
All right. So you pointed out, too, that they're saying, look, these costs are necessary because the cost of all of this stuff is adding up and we have to pay for it. They want to change that law. They are in Tallahassee trying to change that law, right?
We've been told that there is some lobbying happening. I mean, you know, they have a case that this fee hasn't changed since 1992, and they need to cover their costs. They can't be losing money on these fees. You know, at the same time, we live in, you know, the most expensive housing market for renters in the country. And for a lot of renters, you know, ponying up $500 or every time you move into or you rent a new condo is not easy.
Yeah. Have you run into anyone or any of your readers said anything about approaching a condo association and saying, wait a minute, I know the law and you can't charge me this.
Yes. And in fact, yesterday's a couple wrote and they said, we're going to print out your story and take it to the association and we'll see if we get charged. You know, I think it was $350.
So, again, as you said, it is up to the condo associations to know the law. But, I mean, really, are there any repercussions if they, I mean, who's policing this?
So the Florida Division of Condominiums, I'm trying to get the order right, Florida Division of Condominiums, Mobile Homes, and Timeshares was recently granted new powers to start fining associations $5,000 if they violate the law. I think state regulators feel that there's just not enough knowledge that this is illegal out there. And so they receive, I think last year from Dade and Broward, they received 8 complaints. And, you know, there's another point I want to make, too, which is when we did this analysis of, you know, condos charging too much, we did it by neighborhood and city and found that it's highest in areas like Doral, Hialeah, North Miami, Bell Harbor, Sunny Isles Beach, where there are a lot of foreign investors and a lot of recent immigrants. So people who are even less likely than, you know, Florida locals, Miami locals, to know the law.
The chances that you'll find somebody who understands the law exactly. Does this, by the way, only apply to condo associations?
Yes.
Okay. Is Florida seen as relatively more protective of renters' rights compared to other states when it comes to these laws, or no?
I'd say a resounding no. Florida is not known for having the tenant protections that, you know, you might see in California or New York or, you know, other states.
Do we get any sense, by the way, before I let you go, if Tallahassee, if lawmakers are, if they've got the appetite to go ahead and apply this and maybe increase, because again, it's not since the early 90s has the $100 cap been set. So it's been a while since they've looked at this.
No, that's absolutely right. And, you know, the real estate industry certainly has influence in Tallahassee. At the same time, I'd imagine that it would be difficult for a politician to tell voters, hey, I'm going to have to raise your fees. And, you know, background checks, they can be had from FDLE for $25. I know they're more expensive for international buyers, but the industry is going to have to go to Tallahassee and make a strong case that their fees are not being covered.
It's a fascinating story. It's probably, if it's happening that often, then you probably experienced it, and we'd love to hear your story. Remember, if you have paid more than that $100 in fees for your condo, tell us about it. Tell us about what's happened, and maybe you've approached that association, and we'd like to know what happened there. Text us by text the word fee, F-E-E, to 786-786-7636. We'd love to hear your story. Again, we've been talking with investigative reporter Nick Nehemas of the Miami Herald. Nick, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, still to come, are Cubans losing their unique immigrant status in the U.S.? That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us today. Well, last month, 120 Cubans were deported on a small charter plane from Miami back to their home country. The move by the Trump administration raised the ire of a group of Florida House Democrats. One of them was State Senator Jose Javier Rodriguez. He argues the administration needs to reverse the policies that are impacting the Cuban population in Miami-Dade. In 2018, more than 400 Cubans were deported, and that number continues to rise this year. How do the actions by the Trump administration differ from decades of U.S.-Cuba policies? We're joined now by Fabiola Santiago, columnist for the Miami Herald. She joins me here in studio. Fabiola, great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to do a little bit of history here. We got to go back a bit, and let's go back to the early 1980s. Your front page story for the Miami Herald, the 1981 Mario boatlift, set the scene for the U.S.-Cuban relations at that time. What was it like?
Well, in one word, it was chaotic. The 1980 boatlift brought 125,000 Cubans in the span of 5 months to these shores. And it was not it wasn't like the exoduses that preceded it. It wasn't like the freedom flights, which were organized. It wasn't small like the Camarioca boatlift of 1965, which preceded the freedom flights. And, you know, it wasn't like the first exiles who came in the very beginning of the revolution, the Pedro Pans, who were the children, there were 14,000 of those. So imagine the numbers were quite high. The people were not screened. And of course, Fidel Castro opened prisons and mental wards and sent the people here. So it was chaotic. But at the same time, a lot of Cubans here who had family there went on their yachts and boats to pick up relatives who wanted to emigrate. And it was interesting. You would see the row of boats going down Palm Avenue in Hialeah some days until, you know, the whole thing ended. So that the Mariel Boatlift was sort of a game changer in attitude towards Cubans.
And you know what was going on at the time with the attitudes of Americans, Miamians especially, mm-hmm. when all of a sudden you have this massive amount of people coming in?
Yeah. There was anger. You know, the Cubans were very much about picking up their families. You know, they saw it as an opportunity to reunite with loved ones. So, and there were Americans, you know, American boaters lent their boats, shrimpers, you know, there was a part of the population that did rally with the Cubans, but there was a very vocal part of the population that was angry, that began chanting things like "Cubans go home," holding up placards, you know, "Speak English, this is our country." And at the time, I also covered the city of Hialeah, where at that moment, the population was sort of 50-50, 50% Cuban, 50%, we used to call them Anglos. And those meetings were like riotous, with both sides, you know, very, very vocal. You know, Americans were really angry about what was going on, and they wanted there to be no Spanish at all in any of the city documents, nothing. You know, just all the language issue became like the focal point. At the same time, the city was going through the process of processing these refugees, of, you know, resettling them somehow.
And you talk about clashes. There was, I wanted to know a little bit more about that. There was actions that were taken by the immigration director in Miami at the time, and that set off these clashes in the street between police and Cuban exiles. What was going on
there? That was 2 years after the Mariel Boatlift, when things calmed down and, you know, everyone was sort of, you know, already settled in their own in a new life. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, Cubans were no longer coming any which way, but we had a couple of stowaways, and the immigration director in 1982 decided to just take this 22-year-old kid and basically put him back on a plane to Cuba without any warning to anyone, without him having any due process. And this had never been done before. There was just no record of any Cuban being treated that way. And so Cubans did come out in big numbers to demonstrate, very impromptu, no permit, nothing, just by word of mouth on Cuban radio, by people saying, you know, this had happened. And you know, then there were clashes with police. Police was trying to get them off the street. They were in front of the federal building. They had, you know, as the crowds grew, they just took over the streets. And any effort by police to rein it in, you know, just brought pushback. And so it just turned into mayhem.
So after that, you know, it seemed like what, things kind of quieted down until Elian Gonzalez?
Well,
is that when everything?
There's always been some way that Cubans have gotten to the United States, whether it's third country. There's also third country. It's not just now that you're seeing it, you know, in the border. It's not this, that's not really new. It was still happening before through Mexico. Cubans were going from Cuba to Mexico, or they were going through to Spain and then flying to the United States, eventually going to the embassy there, getting some. So, you know, Cubans have always had preferential treatment, no doubt about it. And I think it was the fact that the U.S. was so involved in the island's affairs that made this situation happen, right? They, you know, some of their policies brought, they supported Batista. Without Batista, there would not have been a Fidel Castro, you know, and they were supporters of Batista, who had staged a coup. So there was a moral obligation for the United States to deal with the mess that they created by accepting refugees. So then, you know, Elian happened, and that was, you know, a unique and explosive situation in its own. And then again, we come to a point in history where there is a before Elian, the Cuban exile before Elian, and the Cuban exile after Elian. Because I think that what happened was that because for the first time, Cubans truly were alone in this, on this issue. They wanted the child to remain here in the United States. And then there was the rest of the world that thought, duh, he belongs with his father.
And it reminded me, too, the wet foot, dry foot policy, was that, that came in after.
That, well, that was Clinton. That was before Elian. Elian was in 2000.
Elian was still during the Clinton administration, though, wasn't it?
The Clinton administration's wet foot, dry foot policy was enacted as a response to the Balsero crisis. We skipped a crisis, basically.
Well, there's a lot to cover, and there's a lot of history.
The Balsero crisis happened again, you know, during Mariel. The Mariel happened because Fidel Castro says, okay, everyone who wants to leave, go, right? As a way to get rid of the unhappy people in the country. And so, again, the pressure cooker was on in 1993 with a special period, which is when Castro lost the Soviet subsidies. And there was, you know, hunger and nothing to eat. And the Cubans were truly living in tremendous poverty. And people just were taking to the seas and leaving. And then once again, he said, okay, whoever wants to leave can leave. And that led to what was called the rafter crisis, the Balseros, right? Who, they made their own boats, made their own rafts, and literally took to the seas. And the Clinton administration had the idea of interdicting to Guantanamo. They did not interdict and return to Cuba. They interdicted and took all the refugees to Guantanamo. And those were the first Guantanamo camps that preceded what we have in Guantanamo now.
So it was, the wet foot, dry foot policy was first. It was November 99 was Elian.
Yes.
So it was just in between the two presidents. Mm-hmm. So then, and again, we're jumping through a lot of history here. But so, you know, then we come to the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. He changes the relationship between U.S. Cuba, but then gets rid of wet foot, dry foot.
At the end. He normalizes diplomatic relations, and he starts taking different sorts of measures that address the...
Why did he do that? Was that a good idea? Why end it?
Well, because, you know, I think what Obama did was actually brilliant, because years of isolation had not yielded any results. There was no regime change. And there was an opportunity in Cuba. There was a political opportunity in Cuba, because with Fidel, you know, removed from power due to illness, his brother in, he's seen more of as a reformer, there was an opportunity for conversation. There was an opportunity for negotiation. There was an opportunity to influence Cuba and to bring Americans back to the island. And I do think that the principle of the policy was something positive, and it was embraced on both sides of the Florida Straits.
I'm talking again with Miami Herald columnist Fabiola Santiago. She's been reporting on Miami since the 1980s, and we're talking about these recent deportations of 120 Cubans from Miami. But we're talking a lot of history, so let's jump now to what's going on. And we have to start with, you know, we talked about different presidents and their take on Cuba, U.S.-Cuba relations. Trump, his role in this, What has his policy been on Cuba-U.S. relations?
Well, then, Trump basically takes back the Obama rapprochement. He empties out the embassy. He decides, now he's even enacted the Helms-Burton Law, which allows people to sue for confiscated properties. And so we're back to sort of a mini Cold War. And the Cuban government has responded likewise with increased repression. The level of repression since Trump took over has I've seen it increase. Every single day you hear of some journalist or a dissident or an ordinary person in Cuba who just gets fed up, rounded up, taken to prison. And whereas during the Obama years, what they were doing was basically arresting them, detaining them for a little while, and then releasing them. And it was all, the whole point was that the tourists not see the repression, right?
Right.
And now, with American influence all but gone from the island, the bottom line is that there is more repression and that they ratified a constitution recently that is that basically sets as the country's, as the country's primal law some of the worst repressive measures that we've seen. Things that both before were not even in the books are right. Now in the books.
Right. Well, I'd pointed out it's a few hundred or so more last year, and now we have this 120. Who are these Cubans that have been deported?
Okay, the Cubans deported. All right, so there were 210 Cubans in a single flight, okay? And what is notable about this is that Cuba accepted them. You know, Cuba had not accepted, they did accept the interdicted people from the people who were interdicted before they actually got here, but returning those who actually made it had not quite gotten up to speed. So this was the largest, deportation of Cubans in a very long time, because with the Mariel boat lift, several administrations did try to deport back criminals, and they were successful in some instances. The thing is that the Cuban government, either accepts or doesn't accept, and they do have the prerogative to accept or not accept, which is the reason that there are so many Cubans in this country who have orders of removal, but in essence live in our community and have lived here for decades, right? The particular thing about this group, though, is that there were people in this group who had already passed a credible fear of persecution review, yet they were put on that plane and sent back to Cuba.
What happens right now, because we had reported last week about the Trump administration's move on targeting asylum seekers, requiring individuals, now they have to apply for asylum in the countries that they're traveling through to the U.S. prior to requesting the asylum here. How does this affect Cubans with those aspirations now to get out?
Yeah, Cubans have always traveled to the U.S. through a third country. It has happened historically. So if that is taken away, it really does close off an important route to Cubans. The immigration of Cuban intellectuals to the United States, for example, that happened through third countries, because what would happen is that these Cubans would get an invitation to speak in Toronto or Madrid or, Mexico City to present a theater piece, and then they would defect.
Yeah.
From there, they would defect. So, the asylum, and then interestingly, now we have the stowaway, right?
Right.
That's new too. We hadn't had stowaways in a long time, and he truly is in a predicament, because what he did, and I guess we should explain to listeners.
Right. Who is the stowaway?
Who is the stowaway? Yeah. He's a young man who was a baggage handler in Cuba and at the Havana airport, who on a flight, you know, the flights to Cuba arrive packed with baggage and leave with like nothing in them.
And he hid in baggage.
He saw the opportunity to just, you know, get in there and fly to freedom. And when they opened the plane's belly out, he popped out. So he did pass the credible fear of persecution review, and now his case is before an immigration judge. And the two sides, the interesting thing is that the government's prosecutors, the prosecutor for the Trump administration, argued that things have changed in Cuba, that this young man would not be persecuted, that he would be prosecuted, when, you know, the Cuban judicial system is by no means equivalent to the U.S. system.
Right.
And that tells you right there, you know, that there is a huge discrepancy in Trump-Cuba policy. You can't...
I'm going to have to stop you only because we can dig into this. This is really a fascinating thing, but I have to stop there because of time, and I hate that. Again, talking with Miami Herald columnist Fabiola Santiago, and again, you could find links to her stories on this on our social media, WLRN Sundial. We got to get you back so we can keep talking about this. Fabiola, thank you so much.
Right, thanks for having me.
Well, still to come, a Parkland father honors his son's life in a one-man show. We'll tell you all about it coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. After Manuel Oliver's son, Joaquin, was killed at the Parkland shooting in 2018, he dedicated his life to gun reform activism. His outlet is usually painting, but recently he's focused on theater, and he's out with a new one-man show. It tells the story of his son, Manuel's personal recovery after his son's death, and the things they bonded over, like their love of hot dogs.
Joaquin loved hot dogs. That was a thing. And he would call to my office two or three times per week. Hey, Pa, what are you doing? I'm working. You're calling to my office. Can we have hot dogs tonight? See, I don't see why not. That was an easy, special moment that I could have and enjoy with my son.
The one-man show is called Guac, My Son, My Hero. It debuts at the Colony Theater in Miami Beach September 20th at 8 p.m. WLRN reporter Katie Switalski talked to Manuel Oliver at the Coral Springs Center for the Arts during one of the rehearsals.
You've been using art as activism. Why step into the realm of performance?
This is also art. I paint, and I understood, and I saw that this unconventional way of fighting back what I didn't start was kind of connecting with the youth and working. It was grabbing people's attention. So when it goes to arts, theater, it's also a way of using art to communicate with people. The only barrier that we had is that I've never done this before. And that's an easy barrier because I have never done many things that I do these days.
What does performance help you express that maybe you don't get from painting?
The whole communication process gives you the opportunity to also say things and tell stories about Joaquin and tell stories about Joaquin's mom and Joaquin or Joaquin's sister and Joaquin. So that I don't do when I'm just painting a wall. This is more about the social family side of our tragedy than the political and point of view in terms of gun violence. This adds to what we've been doing, the emotional side of the tragedy.
What does the name Guac stand for? When I hear that name, sometimes I think of guacamole, but what's the significance to you?
It's exactly guacamole, so you're thinking the right thing. Joaquin, can you say Joaquin?
Joaquin.
That's exactly why the nickname is Guac, because for a gringa, for an American person, to say Joaquin, it's pretty hard. So all his friends decided to make that a little easier, and they came out with Guac. Joaquin loved it. He loved the nickname Guac. He's from Venezuela and very proud Latino kid. So he loved that his friends called him Guac. And now these days, many people that never met him know him as Guac.
Wow, I love that. The play will tell the story of Guac, of your son. Can you tell me a little bit more about who he was and what you wanted to capture in this performance about him?
The most important reason why we do this is to give Joaquin a chance to keep on expressing. This is an opportunity for a victim to somehow share its life with others. Usually the victim, it's forgotten. It's like, that's it. And everyone is sad. And I don't want people to be sad about losing Joaquin. I want people to be mad about what happened to Joaquin. And I think that as a father, I have a duty to represent my son, just like if he was here today. Just like if he had an issue in college or in high school, I gotta be there. And I gotta tell everyone here in this audience and in every single venue that we will visit how amazing and great Joaquin not only was, but still is. Because he's leading a change. He's leading a pack of people that is done with this gun violence situation. So I own my son doing this.
So how did you make sure that you captured his personality in its entirety?
I think that I did my parenting role the best possible way. And one rule is to be very good friends. And me and Joaquin are still very good friends. We hang out. We used to go together to almost every single place since he was a very little kid. The way that you represent someone and share his attitude and ideas is to know the person very well. I know Joaquin better than anyone because we were best friends. So everything that I say on this stage, it's coming from Joaquin. I guarantee that because he will be doing the same thing for me. We had that connection that you only have with your best friend. You know, when you see a person to the eyes and you already know what you're thinking, that might happen with your best friend. That's how me and Joaquin will react. And it will always be a message coming from him.
So, Manuel, you worked with a lot of cool people for this show. It was produced by some Broadway greats. How did you get these people to come on board? What was working with them like?
It was amazing, and I think I needed all that experience because I knew nothing about this. So I was like an emergency case, like, hey, this guy, we need a lot of knowledge to make this happen. Otherwise, it's never going to happen. So thanks to Yael Silver, she was involved with the whole Parkland tragedy. She was able to accept the challenge of making this happen, and she found all those amazing people that now are part of our team. However, this is not acting. This is reacting to something. I won't be an actor, and I don't want to be an actor. I am sharing a story. I have the ability to talk to people, and I don't feel shy when I see people in front of me, which is always applause if you're on stage. But other than that, the whole team was able to organize a true story so it will be more comprehensive for people.
How long have you been working on this show? What's it been like to put your vision of what you want to tell people about your son, Guac, into a full-fledged professional production?
We've been working on this for the last 8 months, and it went from a simple story with all the details that I have in my head, and that was transcribed into a theater language that will be more than just a speech, because that I've done also. This needed that entertaining. This is entertaining people in a good way with a bad situation going on. I don't want to make people feel sad, so we needed to work on that. How do we share this experience without making people feel sad? Well, we can't, but we can also make them feel happy, and that will find the balance. When you're sad, and then you're gonna laugh, and then you're gonna cry again, and then you're gonna dance, and then you're gonna sing, we got it.
Tell me about what you do on stage. You paint on stage, you...
I make comments. I don't tell jokes. Some of them are funny. And then I talk a lot about the family, and then I touch the tragedy. We talk about the tragedy in a very unique way. And I paint, and at some point I kind of dance along with the people. It's fun. It has fun moments. I have to admit that it's something that I enjoy doing. I think Joaquin appreciates and loves what we're doing when we do this.
Is it cathartic?
Part of it is. The process of getting here, it wasn't. You have to also understand that when you do what me and Patricia decided to do, you keep refreshing the memory of your son. Every single day, we're either painting a mural or doing theater or on a speech or an event. So we decided to keep in our regular day, full-time Joaquin with us.
How do you want people to feel when they leave the show? What do you want them to walk away with?
At some point, they will identify either with me or with my son or with my wife. And they will see how easy our roles could flip. And they wouldn't need to be on stage while I'm listening to their story. So that's like a call to action from our side. So you can be part of the solution before the tragedy hits you. That's what the main goal here. Make people understand that gun violence, it's a common problem. It could hit you, me. I mean, Joaquin wasn't shot because he was Latino or gay or straight or tall or short or black or white. He was randomly shot.
I'm speaking with Manuel Oliver. He's the father of Joaquin Oliver, a student who was killed at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland. Manuel is out with a new one-man show that tells the story of his son, his personal recovery, and gun violence. His show is this Friday at the Colony Theater on Miami Beach. You can find more information on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Back in August, you were in El Paso, Texas, painting a mural when the horrific shooting occurred at Walmart. What were your initial thoughts? I mean, what did you do when you found out?
I will lie if I tell you that I was surprised. I get a lot of calls every day about shootings, but this one was right where we were. That's the only difference here.
How close were you?
A few miles away. And then when we started meeting with the media at some point knew that we were there, so they started calling. And they asked me if I have a message for the community. And I said, yes, I do have a message. Get out here and use these cameras today to say what you're mad about, to tell everyone what you think that should be done by your politicians, because these cameras won't be here in the next 7 days. And I know that because I had those cameras and I don't have them anymore coming to my house. So you better use them now. And I was right. A few days later, no one was covering the story. I also told them how this is becoming a tradition And in the next 5 days, you will have some crosses in front of that Walmart. And then some mothers will come with teddy bears. And then some kids will draw little stones and place them there. And in a month, someone is going to plan to remove all that and take it to another place. So this is how we treat gun violence in this country. We get used to it. And we were also able to find ways to create a template that will just travel to every single place where a tragedy like this one happens. Parkland is still the before and after because we didn't take that as an option. And we still don't take it.
You were painting a mural in El Paso. What was the mural you were painting?
The mural initially was to honor Joaquin's birthday. We were in El Paso because Joaquin would be turning 19 years old. And he was, he had a lot of passion and he was fighting for the rights of immigrants. And he didn't like the way they were treated when they came to America. So trying to find a right place to do that, we decided to go to El Paso, which is borderline with Mexico. So actually we went to Ciudad Juarez and we were talking to some immigrants that are on hold before they let them come into the United States. So that's why we were there. We had a nice mural with the concept of family separations, and we were, the creative part of it was that our family was separated forever.
And I want to get back to this idea of art as activism. Do you see a future for more plays that deal with social justice?
There's credibility. It's a thing here. And this is not only a play about gun violence and trying to fight. This is a play in which the main actor is a father of a victim. Okay? So that makes it somehow more than a play. It's a combination about activism and a play. If I was an actor, it wouldn't be that impactful. And we thought about that. Can someone play my role later on? I don't think so. Because this is not about acting, as I told you. This is reacting. So I don't see, there are plays out there that touch injustice in many ways, and some of them are very successful. They have a lot of support and they become Broadway shows. I don't think we will ever be a Broadway show. I don't want that.
Your show in Miami Beach is for one night only, but you're taking this on the road. Where are you trying to go? Are you trying to get to, you know, swing states before the 2020 election?
Yeah, we are. We're visiting New York on November. And then next year, we are planning to go on tour. So, yes, we are. This is going to be part of what's going to happen on 2020. And again, it's about throwing ideas that have an ethical point of view more than throwing ideas that will fight back a Republican candidate. Or, of course, we're not in any way promoting any candidate that is in any way related to the NRA or the gun lobby. Those guys are out. And I think we all know that already, and it already happened during the midterms elections. So you don't see them, you don't hear many thoughts and prayers. Nobody will be able to say that and pretend that it's gonna be taken in a good way. So because things are changing, And part of the change is coming from this small little thing that we do along with a bunch of other organizations. We need to do this next year as part of the electoral year that we have.
That was Manuel Oliver talking to WLRN reporter Katie Switalski. Manuel is the father of Joaquin Oliver, a student killed in the Parkland shooting. Manuel is out with a new one-man show that tells the story of his son, his personal recovery, and gun violence. His show is this Friday at the Colony Theater, Miami Beach. You can find more information on WLRN's Sundial Facebook and Twitter pages. Well, that's Sundial for this Wednesday, September 18th. Coming up tomorrow on the program, Congresswoman Frederica Wilson joins us to discuss the push for TPS for Bahamians impacted by Hurricane Dorian. Wilson has family in the Bahamas and is deeply connected to the ongoing recovery efforts happening in her district in South Florida. Plus, the father of slain Parkland student Meadow Pollock is out with a new book. Andrew Pollock has been outspoken in his criticisms of the state following the tragedy, and he'll make his case. And finally, former NBA All-Star and Florida native Amari Stoudemire has a new gig off the court. He's a freshman at FIU. Stoudemire joins us in studio to discuss growing up in Florida, adopting Judaism, and his charity work. And by the way, don't forget that we're reading Miami Midnight by Alex Segura for the Sundial Book Club. We're going to be talking with him tomorrow. That interview airs next week. But if you have a question for Alex, share it on our Facebook page, Sundial Book Club. We'll share some of those questions with him. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll talk to you tomorrow.